Welcome to the Punk and Pile Drivers Podcast here on the Backbreaker Media Network. And now, your host, Big Bad Boris.
Yes, my children, it is once again time for another episode of the Punk and Pile Drivers Podcast. My name is Big Bad Boris, and I'm back on the Zoom machine, the technological highway, and joining me is one of the best guys I know, one of my best friends, and yet also one of my biggest nemesis, which I think is plural for nemesis, Mr. Andy Anderson. Andy, it's a pleasure to speak with you, my friend.
Well, it's after an introduction like that, the pleasure is definitely all yours.
Yeah, some things never change.
Some things never change, but no, I'm very happy to be here. I am very happy to be connecting with you. And as a wise man once said, I am very excited to be here.
Because, I mean, truth be told, partly because of the pandemic and partly because I've been very much a hermit over the past, like, all year almost. I don't think we've been face-to-face for a long time. And I will take 99% of the blame for that because I've been very hermit-like over the past little while. But, we haven't seen each other in a while.
It's very true, and it's... It's tough. I mean, there's a lot of things that have been going on through the world in general, through your world, through my world. Mm-hmm. And as much as I'd like to shovel the responsibility onto people at the 99%, also over the past year and a bit, I think with what's been going on, I too have become quite the hermit.
Yeah.
So it doesn't lay solely on you. But here we are, and hopefully it's just the beginning of... A regenesis of sort, if you will.
We're going to rectify that soon, I hope. I'm excited to have you here because you have a lot of good stories. Much like Lisa Stanfield, you have been around the world. You get that reference?
Yeah.
See, I knew you would get it. I don't know if anybody else gets that. You have your wrestling career has literally taken you all over the world. You wrestled obviously extensively in Puerto Rico, in the States a lot, throughout the South and other places. You did some stuff in Mexico. You had one tour of Japan, correct?
No, three tours of Japan.
Three tours of Battle Arts, I want to say.
Yep.
All three.
Yep.
And so you've told me a lot of stories over the years, and the stories never cease to make me laugh. So I thought we'd start off by asking you to tell some of my favorite stories, because I believe you are responsible for one of the greatest ad-lib lines in WWE Raw history. And you know, you already know where I'm going with this.
Yes.
Because you said, and I quote, Vince McMahon cares about all his employees. So everybody know, or a lot of people know, you were you played the role of a security guard during a Monday Night Raw back in the smack dab in the heart of the Attitude Era, trying to keep Stone Cold Steve Austin from getting into the arena. Take us back to how you kind of got that gig and I'm sure you've probably told the story already, but I don't care. I want you to tell it again.
That's okay.
How you got that gig and what it was like to produce that kind of stuff and where that line came from, because it never ceases to make me giggle.
All right. Well,
you think Vince McMahon cares about you? Well, Vince McMahon cares about all his employees.
And that's funny because there's actually, like, I don't know if you remember, but there's like a legit kind of inside shot when I said that, and it was all just off the cuff. But
can I cut you off for one second?
That was back in.
I'm going to cut you off for one second. I apologize. Given the super scripted nature of the way things are there now, do you think that you would have gotten heat as an extra for ad-libbing like that?
Or that's a good question.
Like, I don't know. Would they have had?
I don't know. It'd be tough.
Would they have had what you did because, instead written right out?
I mean, I don't know. That's, you know, that might be for some other people we know. They might have a better idea of that than I would, since I haven't really been backstage. Well, I've been backstage at WWE events, but not to that extent, like with television and production.
Okay.
You know, I mean, more often than not, when we see things with the extras now, like, they don't really talk at all. And this particular episode, you know, I was featured multiple times. Plus, I was engaged in conversation, and none of that was scripted.
All right. So take us back. Take us back to how you were approached with this and how it all went down.
Okay, so that episode of Monday Night Raw took place, I think it was like May 13th or May 20th, 1998. It was like somewhere in May 98, Nashville, Tennessee. It also featured the debut, the television in-ring debut of Val Venus.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yep. And I want to, was there something else in there too? There might have been something else that was kind of a note. Because there was some intertwining of the stories there. At this time, Jerry Lawler was also sneaking in Al Snow into the building underneath.
Right.
Yeah.
Under a sheet or whatever?
Yeah, under the blanket. And promising Al a meeting with Vince or whatever. So prior to that, there was a wrestler that I knew. Actually go this way. I had had some time prior to that in Tennessee in the South in late 1996 and part of 97. So March of 1998, I moved down to Nashville. At the time, I was based out of Winnipeg, Manitoba,
where I was doing
most of my wrestling, my training. It could be worse. Could be Calgary.
Hey.
But so I got down there. And, you know, you're connecting and working and with people and whatnot. And there was another independent wrestler from Michigan. His name was Chad Casey. He was down there. We kind of
hit it off. Who'd he ever beat?
Right. I think he beat me.
Well, who hasn't?
But then again, who hasn't?
I have.
I know.
It only took 6 minutes for me to mention that, by the way. Anyway, continue.
So at one point, somehow Chad knew Victor Quiñones, who was, for those that don't know, Victor Quiñones was a promoter in Puerto Rico. He did a lot with IWA Japan, did a lot of stuff like the death matches with like Terry Funk, Mick Foley, Leatherface.
Yeah, IWA Japan is the company that did that famous King of the Deathmatch tournament that Mick Foley won that they used all those clips for back when they were kind of establishing the three faces of Foley back in the day.
Yes,
just to give a little backstory on that.
Yep. So somehow Chad knew Victor, and at the time Victor was working with WWF. He was also involved because at the time they were doing the program for Latin America. They were doing WWF Super Astros.
I love Super Astros.
So they were using like the some of the Mexican talent and the Latin talent there. At the time, the Boricuas out of Puerto Rico. So it was like Miguel Perez, Hurricane Castillo, Jose Estrada Jr., Savio Vega. That's when they were kind of doing like a lot of the gang warfare stuff.
If we were in person right now, I'd pick up all those names you just dropped.
I wasn't saying that I worked directly with them, but that's just the involvement. Yeah. So I'll do some more of the name dropping later. So just keep your heads up. So that's kind of how Victor had, you know, his kind of hands in some of that stuff there. So, the other thing was, and I think maybe this was part of the tie-in too, because of Japan and whatnot, Victor also knew Gypsy Joe. For those of you that don't know Gypsy Joe, he's like, you know, old school, old time wrestler, Japan, the States, everything, tough guy. Worth kind of digging up just to kind of get some information on him, looking up to see who he is if you're not aware of him.
If you watch the New Jack kind of Dark stuff, Side of the Ring, you know exactly who Gypsy Joe is because New Jack tried to kill him.
Oh, really? Okay?
Yeah.
There you go. And I actually worked with Gypsy. I actually worked with Gypsy Joe in McMinnville, Tennessee and put him over.
Attaboy.
Yeah. So we went to a show. I think it was on the Sunday. Dad was booked for a show. Small town Tennessee. So he's like, come to the show, come hang out and meet Victor. So came to the show, met Victor, and Victor's like, well, you know, why don't you guys come to Raw, because we're doing it Monday in Nashville, and maybe we can see if we can get you guys to do something, at least get you guys paid or something like that. So we're like, of course. So we're thinking, you know, dark matches, whatever. So the Monday we get there, we're kind of hanging out, and at some point I think it was like somehow we got called in to catering. I don't know if it was Tony Garea that called us in there or he was, whatever it was. Victor was at a table. There was a few other guys there. And Chad and I walked, Victor points to me and goes, yeah, here, this is the guy that I was telling you about. And so right away, I still remember, like, my heart kind of like jumped into my, you know, kind of leaped up into my throat. So I'm thinking, okay, like, I'm getting a dark match. Like, this is awesome. And it's like, well, no. So we're here. We're going to film some stuff, and we want you to be a security guard. You know, are you interested? Of course, you say yes. So that was it. So and this was at the Nashville Arena where the Predators played. Actually, so 1998, it was still the Nashville Arena because there was nobody kind of sponsored or buying in, and this was the same year that the Nashville Predators would debut in the National Hockey League, but to this point, they hadn't played yet.
Okay.
So I'm like, yeah, you know, whatever. So they whisked me off, and they got me some of the Nashville Arena security guards. They had the pants and the, you know, I think somebody lent me a pair of shoes or something, and the jacket, and I had like kind of the buzz cut. So I kind of had that security guard look. I don't remember all who was there, but I mean, key players obviously was Steve Austin. And Vince Russo was the one that was kind of directing and kind of producing the segments.
Did he say bro a lot?
I don't remember, but I don't think so.
I think it's the same.
But he, from what I recall, like, he was cool. You know, Steve Austin was awesome throughout the whole thing. And so what basically ensued, we did a few pre-tapes, and that was kind of the first stuff you saw. So the storyline was Austin, or Vince had banned Austin from the building. So in the first segment, the parking was underground for talent. So Steve drives in, he's got the pickup truck, and he comes walking up to the door. I come running out from the security area. I'm like, hey, you know, Mr. Austin, I'm sorry. Like, Mr. McMahon just said, you know, you're not allowed in the building. And he's like, well, I'm gonna go have some beers. And it's not like we're promoting drinking and driving on TV. I'm gonna go have some beers. And when I come back, we're gonna do this the easy way or hard way. So, okay. And then we go, they, you know, whatever, do a couple segments later, they come back and it's like, oh, here, you know, here we go again. And Austin goes to pass me, and you know, we're kind of standing face to face. He goes to pass me. I put my hand on his chest to stop him.
Oh boy.
Of course, that's, you know, not a good idea. Yeah. So it's being the nice guy that he was, though, he puts his arm around me and goes to have a, you know, a little chat with me, you know, because we're kind of like, you're going to do this the easy way or the hard way. And, so we're talking, and he says, I think he said something like, you know, you think Vince McMahon cares about you? And so as the top of the story, as you kind of, when you're introducing it, that's where I replied. And again, there was no script. There was nothing. This was just us. And I said, well, I'm sure Mr. McMahon cares about all his employees. Now, the basis for that, so even though this was 98, the Montreal screw job was in November of 97?
97, yeah.
Yeah, so less than a year. So it's still fresh. And being the good Canadian boy that I was, and for everything that went down, that was, for whatever, in that one moment, that was kind of my shot back. Whatever little, this Canadian guy in the middle of Nashville, Tennessee, like, it was going to make any sort of difference. It was like, yep, here you go. Mr. McMahon cares about all his employees. And at that point, I get spun around, and he throws me into the big bay door, starts, you know,
they love those big bay doors, but they make a lot of noise.
They make a lot of noise, they sound great, and you know, so he did that. And our first segment, I think we only did like one or two takes. That segment was like one or two takes. I remember I actually offered, I said, you know, like, do you want me to take a stunner? And I wasn't really thinking, you know, I'm just, hey, like, I'm trying to do whatever I can. And he's like, no, I says, I don't want to hurt my ass on the concrete. Yeah, although I was thinking, in retrospect, I thought about this, like, not long afterwards, is I should have said, well, if you want, like, throw me into the bed of the, because you have the pickup truck. It's like, throw me into the bed of the pickup truck. And then you probably could have, like, you know, like, dropped down into a stunner right at the edge, right off the tailgate.
Yeah.
I'm sure that probably looked pretty sweet, but yeah. Hindsight. But anyways, so there was that. And then the next segment they did, which was also pre-taped, was they had me with two of Nashville's finest. We had two police officers, and now they were talking with me, and we had to go hunt down Steve Austin somewhere in the arena.
Were these shoot cops or working cops?
Yeah, no, these were legit cops. Whoa, they actually used legit cops, yeah. Yeah, and so that was the whole thing, is we got to find Steve Austin, and, you know, he's got to be arrested because he wasn't supposed to be coming in here. He assaulted a security guard. So they got us walking down the hallway. And then I think at one point they asked Tony Garea and he's like, oh yeah, I think he went that way. And then another point, another segment, we stopped Jerry Lawler because he was coming out of a minivan and that's where he had Al Snow underneath the blanket. And I actually go to look under the blanket and Al Snow's there. And there's that. There's that one, I think. Is that the lot? There might have, I can't remember if there was one more or not, but I mean, it ended up being about 4 or 5 segments, which, you know, like for an extra that someone's not under contract. And again, no script or something. This is, I think even to this day is probably pretty.
That's
pretty
a lot rare. Of FaceTime.
Yeah. But wait, there's more. So all this stuff was pre-tape. And I think I was kind of sitting around by the monitor watching with Chad and then whatever the talent was sitting there. And then somebody from production or something come and they find me is like, okay, like, you know, you got to come, you got to put the stuff back on. We're going to do one more segment. We're going to do it live. Awesome. So, like, oh, okay. Yeah. So what that was, and this was the final segment. They got me dressed back up is that they had found Steve Austin and they had arrested him and they handcuffed him. They had him in the back of the police car. And basically what it turned out to be is like, look, like, we'll let you go if you apologize to the security guard.
Oh, okay. I don't remember that.
And yeah. So he's like, you want me to apologize? You want me to say sorry? He's like, okay, fine. He says, you're like, I'm sorry. He says, you know, I'm sorry. I kicked your ass. I'm sorry. You're a dumb son of a bitch. I'm sorry. You know, like all this stuff. So, and then the last thing he does is he does like the double flip off. And the last shot you get before they go to commercial is just to me, like my jaw dropped, my eyes like wide open, like what the hell just happened? And that was that. So that's that story of my run-in with Steve Austin. So I probably one of the few people that had a run-in with Steve Austin that didn't have to take a stunner. And then with around Nashville for a while there, it didn't work out well, but Bill Behrens, who was working with Music City Wrestling, along with Bert Prentice, which was like the main promotion I was working out of. He was trying to get me over with, Mr. Monday Night? Oh, no, Mr. Cable TV. That's what it was, Mr. Cable TV.
Okay.
It's just kind of like, because I think it was like Rob Van Dam was, I don't think he was Mr. Monday Night, but he was something. And I think that was kind of like the little kind of thing that they were trying to play off of there, but it didn't really get any traction, so it didn't really go too far.
So was that your first time on WWE TV?
Yes,
but not your last.
Yes, it was. No. And actually, if I'm sure we've discussed this, but, at the time, because this was the Attitude Era, this was right in the midst of the Monday Night Wars. I think it was like the following week or 2 weeks later.
Yeah. You were supposed to do something with WCW and they said,
yes.
No, right? Yeah.
Because WCW, was filming Thunder from the, what was it down? Not the year. I forget the name of it. It was like the other kind of like old, the Municipal Auditorium, National Municipal Auditorium. So they were filming Thunder there and Chad and I were backstage there again. And also I was there with Debbie Combs. She's an old school female wrestler, tough as nails. She ended up being kind of like a big sister to me through the years
you
in
said
wrestling.
To me, you said very, very, very nice things about Debbie Combs.
Yeah. Oh, Debbie. Yeah. Debbie Combs. She was a second generation because her mom, Cora Combs, was also a lady wrestler. And actually it was through her. That was the one time I met Macho Man Randy Savage was okay. Backstage at that show. And at one point, this is apparently very quiet, but I think Debbie had actually dated Savage for a while.
Oh, okay.
And it was kind of funny because he was kind of eyeballing me when I was with her.
Oh.
And I think he just kind of like sizing me up and checking me out. She told me, I was like, yeah, like, don't worry about it. I mean, obviously there's nothing to worry about because he wasn't with Liz or anything, but it's just like, there wasn't anything there. So I think it was just a pass, like, you know, like who's the young guy kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But,
you do that way, but
thinking. Uh-huh. Messing around. Not sure if I like that. So there was that. So anyways, actually, I think that was also the one time I met Bret Hart because he was already in WCW at that point. And so that was the one time I met Bret. And where was I going? Okay, so what was supposed to happen, there was, I think it was a hardcore match involving Raven.
Sounds like
Raven,
something
and I forget
they would
who
do.
Else. Yeah, I forget who else was involved, but it was Raven, because Raven was kind of one that seemed to be kind of like organizing slash producing this. And what they were looking for was they were going to have someone who was going to be a vendor in the crowd with like the big thing of popcorn. Okay. And then, of course, somehow that would get knocked. And he had me picked. And then I think, I don't know if it was Chad or somebody, somehow it came out that I had been on Raw 2 weeks before. And then Raven was like, oh, if that's the case, and you know, people might pick up on that, and it's probably not good. And so, yeah, we're not going to use you.
Well, that's a bummer.
So that's kind of, yeah. So it would have been cool. I mean, not the, you know, Rick Rude, you appear on Raw and Nitro on the same night, but to be in the, you know, an extra in two programs within 2 weeks, that wouldn't have been too bad. But that was kind of my main extra experience with WWF and almost WCW.
Well, you did have another extra appearance, but we'll talk about that a little later. I'm going to get another quick story that I like, because I think this can be quick, and then we'll go to your first track. I don't remember who it was you were working, but I don't know why this story always tickles me, but you were working somebody in the South. And
I bet I already know what story this is.
Is it the chance to finish because they got blown up story?
Yes.
I don't know why this story tickles me, but I love it. I can't remember who it was though. Was it Flash Flanagan?
No, it was not. Oh no, it wasn't Flash. Flash Flanagan or Flash Venomous, right? He's known in Puerto Rico. No, and he's an awesome, awesome guy. I love Flash. I could, you know, talk about him for a while, but I've known him. He's one of the longest kind of friendships that I've had in the wrestling business. And I would say the longest, like, non-Canadian, because I mean, you know, the guys that I broke in with Winnipeg that I've been friends with. But from the very first time that I went to the States and wrestled, and Flash was cool with me then, and our paths were intertwined a bunch of times. So it was not him. It was second generation superstar Jamie Dundee.
That's who it was. Right.
Yes.
So and explain this story.
Okay, so we were in Lebanon, Tennessee, which I think is like, east of Nashville. Not too far. I'd venture to say almost Nashville, Lebanon, I think would almost be like Edmonton, St. Albert, or maybe at most like Edmonton, Spruce Grove.
So like a suburby sort of a thing.
Yeah, suburby kind of thing, somewhere maybe 10 minutes, whatever. But it was a place that we ran regularly. And the idea was, I think was I heel? I was probably a heel. But whatever. So Jamie was supposed to go over. We were supposed to go... No. It was a Broadway. That was the whole thing. Right. We were supposed to do a 15-minute Broadway. And I think we got like 10 minutes in, and I forget what happened, but somehow it feels like with a sunset flip or something like that. And it was just, I ended up pinning him, and I was like, oh shit. and I remember he said something about like, he's like, no, screw it. He says, I'm blown up. And so that was just, that happened. And then all of a sudden, like, that was it. But then we got back and there was no heat because, you know, like Jamie, I mean, you know, Jamie's a vet and he's been around, and he was just like, yeah, I used to, I got blown up. He says, I put him over. He says, I didn't care.
Well, that's a nice way to get a win. All right.
So, yep. Yeah.
What promotion was that?
A rare victory. That was with Music City Wrestling.
Music City Wrestling.
So when I was in Nashville, for about a month in, I think, like October, November of 97. And then from March to August of 98, Music City Wrestling was like my, kind of like my mainstay. So there was usually like 2 to 3 shows a week with Music City. We'd usually do Tuesday was Louisville, Kentucky. Saturday was Nashville. And then Friday would be like Lebanon or somewhere else. Sundays, I'd usually get to wrestle Georgetown, Kentucky with Mountain Wrestling Association. That was with my my big thing with Tracy Smothers.
Okay.
We love talking about Tracy, and Tracy was awesome. I learned so much riding with him.
Yeah, you've always spoken very kindly about him. We were very sad when he passed.
And that's the working with him. That was, I think, one of the only times I needed a police escort out of the building. In Georgetown, Kentucky. So
that's,
that was
good,
like,
stuff.
See. Yeah. Tuesday. And it got to a point, like, I was I was in that time, I was wrestling on average 4 to 5 nights a week, but I know there was like certain weeks that I was actually wrestling like 7 nights a week with like little like independence and stuff. And then for a while, Music City was doing, we were running at a bar. It was a multi-level bar just off of Broadway, and we would do the show. And the timing of it's like, I think they're like Raw started like at 8 o'clock. So we would have our show from like 6 till 7:45 or whatever.
Oh, okay.
And then it would like lead into Monday Night Raw, which people would be able to watch there. So it was like, that was like Monday. Then Tuesday was Louisville. Wednesday, Thursday would be like, you know, for the odd spot show. Friday was usually McMinnville, Tennessee. And then Saturday was Nashville, and then Sunday was Georgetown, Kentucky.
What a great way to get experience, though. You must have learned a ton just getting reps in and being around all those guys. Awesome.
The best and constantly. Like it's, you know, between that and Puerto Rico, like that's, you know, if you're doing it for the love of the business and you're trying to learn, you're trying to improve, and you have the passion for it, like what better place is there to be?
That's very true. Now we're going to go, speaking of passion, we're going to go to your first track. You've gone a little Southern on this one as well. You picked a classic, a little Sweet Home Alabama. Skinner, give me the reasoning why.
Well, for those that know me, you know, sort of well or whatever, however well you know me, I'm an Elvis guy. First and foremost, Elvis is my number one. Elvis Presley, Kid Rock is my number two. So people, you know, when they say like, "Oh, like, what's your favorite song?" and they assume it's like an Elvis song, but "Sweet Home Alabama" for the longest time has been like my favorite all-time song. It's a feel-good song for me. Going back to just to like the 80s and stuff, I don't know. There's just some kind of like good, positive vibe to it. It seemed that for a lot of concerts. Not that I went to a lot in the 80s, but even like the 90s and early 2000s, it seemed like a lot of bands or the guitar players, you know, if they were doing a solo or they were doing a little something, a lot of times you kick into that Sweet Home Alabama riff. Mm-hmm. And it just always kind of like stuck with me. And the second time I saw Rob Zombie in concert here in Edmonton, he broke into Sweet Home Alabama.
Really?
So it's just, yeah, it's just one of those things that I don't know. It's a very feel good song for me. And that's why it's my first choice.
Do you think that Ronnie Van Zant was really buried in a Neil Young t-shirt?
Oh, shoot.
That's one of the rock and roll.
One of those things. Yeah.
Because they apparently had
and I know at one point that was the whole thing with the Sweet Home Alabama, but then there was like something that they had made up, something about like with even like with Neil Diamond's wife saying something or Ronnie Van Zant. I don't think so.
You're probably right. All right, let's go to the track. Let's feel good. It is Sweet Home Alabama, Lynyrd Skynyrd on the Punk and Pile Drivers podcast. Big wheels, come on, turn.
Well, I heard Mr. Young sing about her.
Skinnard on the Punk and Power Drivers, Punk and Power Drivers podcast. Easy for me to say. On the Backbreaker Media Network, my name is Big Bad Boris, joined by Andy Anderson. Now, this might change the tone a little bit of this podcast, but now,
okay,
you wrestled Jose Gonzalez, did you not?
Yes.
After it happened, correct?
Yes. Are we going to go a little deeper into who Jose Gonzalez is?
Okay, well, I'm not going to lie. I want to sound cool.
Are you feeding me?
Well, I'm so, a little bit of both. I want to sound cool and I'm feeding.
Okay.
Jose Gonzalez was Invader, what number? Invader 3?
I think it was Invader number 2.
Invader number 2, number and three. He is the man who, I don't know, for legal reasons, allegedly murdered Bruiser Brody in the bathroom in Puerto Rico. Now, A, have you worked in that venue where that happened?
Yes, I have. I've worked in the venue. I was in there. I think we did at least one or two big shows there. And I know that Dutch Mantel, someone else that was around at that time that happened, he was also there. And I do remember kind of the goosebumps kind of being in the dressing room. But having said that, I remember, was it Dutch or Savio? One of them saying, like, they'd actually, like, since then, because that would have been, like, early 2000s that I had been there, that they had since renovated the stadium. So, like, it wasn't the exact same shower.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't the exact same bathroom. So, it's not like, you know, you're going there and it's like, oh, this is, like, the, you know, the same tiles or the same, you know, same room. But, yeah, it's, I just remember it's kind of like, wow, like it's your sort of like, this is
like, it's kind of heavy, right?
Right in the middle of a murder scene. Yeah.
So what was it like being in the ring with him? Did you, what were your interactions with him like?
I don't think I had too many interactions with him. So how this kind of came about, '98. So that was the same. So like when I first met, Victor and I did the Monday Night Raw stuff, after the Monday Night Raw, like that night, It was myself, Chad, Victor, Val Venus, Taka Michinoku, and S.A. Rios.
I'll pick those names up for you later, too.
Thank you. Yeah, I hope you didn't get hit in the head. They were all kind of like Victor's guys, so that's why. Like so we went for supper, and when that was done, he was kind of like, "Hey, like, you know, when you're done in Tennessee." You know, you're like, you're a good kid and you did well. Like, and if I can help you out, then, you know, give me a call and we'll see what we can do. So that was May 98. By August, now the reason I had to leave end of August was because, and I don't know if it still applies now, but when I was down in the States, I didn't have work papers. So I crossed the border. And I think the thing was, is that, you know, like for the snowbirds and that is you have to spend at least one more day in Canada during the calendar year than the States.
Yeah. Cause I don't know what it's like now, but I don't know if you're familiar with a wrestler by the name of Speedball Mike Bailey. He's an indie guy. And a few years ago, he was creating quite a buzz. He's from Montreal. I believe he's Montreal. I know he's Canadian though. And he was creating a bit of a buzz in the States. He worked PWG a few times. I think he worked Ring of Honor and stuff. And he got caught working in the States with the proper permits and stuff. And right when he was really getting a buzz, was banned from working in the States for 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Like a really crazy thing. So you, I don't know if it was like that back when you were there.
I think it was. So I think stuff. I got lucky. And I know like even working in Mexico a couple of times crossing into the States, like I had a tourist visa, but you know, there was once where, cause we worked some border towns and we'd cross over into the States, you know, like for a meal or to, you know, grab a couple groceries or something. And I remember one time kind of come back through and then there was a couple of us and like, you guys aren't the wrestlers. And we all had, like, we were all wearing masks at the time. It's like, you know, you're not the luchadors. It's like, nope. I was like, okay. So I think the only thing worse than being busted in the US would have been being busted in Mexico.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding.
But, so anyways, when I was set to leave Nashville and I was going to go back to Winnipeg, I called Victor and said, you know, hey, like I'm done here. If there's any opportunities for anything, you know, please keep me in mind. And I drove back to or Winnipeg. So that took me kind of 2 days. I think I drove, I did 18 hours the first day. I drove from Nashville to just outside of Minneapolis, and then Minneapolis to Winnipeg the second day. And keep in mind, like, I think I had a cell phone, like a big brick one, but I mean, that was like in case of emergency. So it's not like, you know, like we use them now. Mm-hmm. So by the time I got to Winnipeg, and in Winnipeg, my grandma lived there. So that's who I stayed with when I was there training and all that. So she was kind of my base. So when I got back there, so the 2 days later, or the day and a half later, whatever, she said, yeah, the message for you, there was like a Victor Quinones that called and he wants you to call him. So I called Victor back. He's like, how'd you like to go work in Mexico? And I was like, well, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So end of August. So that was like, the month of October, November, for 2 months, I went and worked out of Monterrey, Mexico. The promotion, I forget what the name of it was, but it was like Triple L. So it was like something Lucha Libre. And they were associated with CMLL. Mm-hmm. So I got to, and so the same thing, I got there, I was working, I think like 4 or 5 nights a week, off in the double shot on Sundays. And I got to work with, you know, some local guys, but I also, a lot of the top talent from CMLL would come in to Monterrey, or the, you know, some of them would come in to headline the other shows we were doing. So at the time, like, you know, I start dropping names again, but I got to kind of work with a who's who in Mexico. So that was finishing, and October, November. And I, so I came back to Edmonton and I was talking with Victor, and IWA, so 98, IWA hadn't started yet. But WWC, which was Capital Wrestling, which was like Carlos's promotion, which is where Invader was and those guys, they were running. And Victor's like, well, how'd you like to come to Puerto Rico for 3 weeks and wrestle with this company? So I can put you like with like Ricky Santana, Fidel Sierra, a few of these guys, you know, and you can get some experience in Puerto Rico. So yeah. So that's how I went. And that's it was Ricky Santana, Fidel Sierra, Shane the Glamour Boy, and Bad Boy Brett Sanders, who would later go on to be the Saigo, or as you call him, Red Shirt Guy.
That's Red Shirt Guy, right?
Yeah, it was Red Shirt Guy, yes. So those are the guys. And Shane was a Canadian. He used to be tag team partners with Val Venus, Sean Morley, because that's where Sean was doing a lot of work in Puerto Rico before WWF. So I got to go for 3 weeks and rode with those guys. Now, Puerto Rico, for those of you that don't know, especially to this point, they were still believing in professional wrestling. So it was still kind of put over as, you know, more sport versus sports entertainment.
Well, there's stories of just crazy fans in Puerto Rico.
Oh,
were telling me that's why they, like, the barricades were so far back from the ring a lot, is because the fans were so crazy.
Yeah, that's why there wasn't really, from, you know, until IWA started doing it in the early 2000s, they didn't have ringside. They would be like in the basketball arenas, like the canchas, the gyms.
Yeah.
And we'd have the ring set up right, you know, at center court, and there'd be nothing ringside.
Yeah, just
would be the bleachers.
Nothing to the bleachers. Yeah. And I almost thought that looked funny until you explained it to me. And I was like, oh, that's explained.
Yeah. Yeah. But so anyways, and they had it where the heels came out on one side and the baby faces came out on the other side. So there was no you know, there was very little communication. The referee might be able to like run a finish back and forth, maybe a spot or two, but everything else was call it in the ring.
Another great learning experience, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so one of the first matches I had was a tag match, and I'd have to check, 'cause I know I have it written down somewhere. I want to say it was Invader and Ricky Santana, I could be wrong, versus me and was it Frankie Lane or Frankie Lancaster? He was someone that would sometimes do enhancement work for WCW.
Okay.
But anyways, we were the heel team, Invader, and if it was Ricky, they were the face team. And I remember that, like, the match started with me and Invader, and I remember this was, well, standing across the ring, and it was like, it's like, I'm in the ring with the guy that killed Brody, and then we locked up.
That's wild.
Yeah, but I mean, it was all fine. Like, there, you know, never any issues, and you know, like, I'm pretty easy to work with. I mean, I'm not gonna, you know, I to this day, like, I don't profess to be like an overly tough guy or anything, but I mean, I don't, you know, never gotten taken advantage of or anything. And mm-hmm. I think part of that was honestly just being like a nice guy, a good guy. And I don't know, I probably carried myself well enough that no one really tried to do anything. So it was all fine. It was all good. And those first 3 weeks were a great experience in Puerto Rico. I mean, I haven't been there in, you know, 20 years, but it was a beautiful place. And when you're a guy that's, you know, single guy, you're living on an island and you're somewhat of a superstar being on TV a couple times a week, it's not too many better places you could be.
And did you make a sexy time with the ladies? Or do we not talk about that?
First of all, I'm a gentleman. Ooh. Believe it or not. So, I mean, I won't go into the details, but I will say this, and you know, so some of them that, you know, for those again that know me really well, like my head was like buried deep into wrestling. Like that's my thing. I mean, like, you know, like don't drink, don't smoke, don't, no drugs, like nothing. Like I was wrestling. That was, I mean, you know, I'd still like to go out, and even though like I don't drink, like it was still nice to go out and hang with the guys and stuff like that. And, you know, you meet some of the locals, and you establish some friends. Like even to this day, like I still have some friends that I keep in touch with in Puerto Rico. Again, like I haven't seen them in like 18, 20 years, but we're still in contact thanks to social media. So I'm grateful for that. But no, I was always more, you know, more about the wrestling.
How's your Spanish? I know sometimes when we'd be watching Lucha, you would you'd be able to pick up on little bits and pieces here and there.
It's okay. I mean, when I was there, like I you know, started picking up Spanish in Mexico. I learned very quickly that, you know, like Mexican Spanish and Puerto Rican Spanish was quite different. Also because the first time I was there, that October, November, 98, Victor had also sent, there was another guy from the States, from Florida. He was billed as the American Destroyer. I forget what his name, Eddie something. And the other guy that he sent was Ricky Banderas, who was just getting breaking into the business. And like he's like El Macias. And was he King Macias right now in MLW or something?
King Cueto or something? I can't remember. But yeah, he's in MLW right now, yeah.
Yeah, or King Muertes, I think.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. But so Ricky was breaking in, and that's where I learned, because, you know, he was there and his English was so, but he spoke the Spanish. So, you know, we'd be in a group and he'd be talking a bunch of stuff, and then whatever, if he went back to his hotel room or something, and then the Mexicans would be like, we have no idea what he said. So I learned some of the Mexican Spanish there. I was taking notes. I would go to the movies. The movies were subtitled. English with the Spanish subtitles, so I would learn that way and try to practice. And then in Puerto Rico, it was the same thing. It's just, you know, you're constantly surrounded by it, and then you get some of the Puerto Ricans that want to practice their English, and so, you know, they'd speak English to you and you'd speak Spanish to them, and it got to a point quite often IWA would send wrestlers, what would it be like? Was it like the breakfast TV kind of thing? But it would be like kind of okay. like the lunchtime one. Mm-hmm. So on like Fridays, you know, you could go in and they'd send a group of us, and it'd be like, okay, like, you know, or no, it'd be like, when would they do it? Maybe Wednesday. I think it was maybe Wednesdays, because we'd say like este jueves, this Thursday, and Ocancha, Bajo Techo de Manatee, you know, this Thursday night in the building in Manatee. You know, some of the matches here would be this, and then Friday. So like each of us would kind of get to little say a bit. And then eventually got to a point where sometimes they'd just be like, they'd send like one person. And even with me, like they're comfortable enough to say, hey, like, can you go do the show? I was like, yeah, no problem. Hmm. And come on, and, you know, like a 30-second spot. And I'd just do my little bit in Spanish, and that was that. So it got to be pretty good. I mean, over the years, I don't use it as much. So, you know, without using it, it kind of, I don't know.
It's like a muscle disappears. If you don't exercise it goes.
Yeah, away. But it's not. It's. I think it's still. I'd probably still do all right.
So tell me, what do you like on your hot dogs?
What do I like on my hot dogs? Where are we getting a hot dog from?
We're getting a hot dog from the Northlands Coliseum.
From the Northlands Coliseum.
Or was it the Saddle Dome? I can't remember where you got your hot dogs from. I think you know where I'm going with this.
Oh, now I do. Okay. It took me a moment.
Where did you get the word?
I'm trying to think of where we were together. I'm like, hot dogs.
You and I have never gotten hot dogs together. Where did you get your hot dogs?
No.
Was it the Northlands Coliseum?
Yes, it was the Northlands Coliseum. Oh, okay. Oh, this one. All right.
So
the Northlands Coliseum, on this particular night, I liked extra mustard.
It was a Monday, was it not, this night?
It was a Monday. It was a Monday night. Yes, it was.
And you had your hot dogs. You donated them to somebody, didn't you? Oh, no, you didn't. Somebody knocked them over.
No, I did not. Somebody stole them and then knocked them over.
God damn. And who did the nicest guy in wrestling too, right? Tommy Dreamer. So this was back in the day when Tommy Dreamer was doing like the gross stuff and drinking the chewing tobacco the barbicide and stuff. And he stole your hot dogs.
Yes.
Tell the story.
Yes. So this was in 2002. And the reason why I remember this, because this would have been, I think it was like May 2002. And I had broken my collarbone in a tables, ladders, and chairs match in early April.
That we still can't find Super footage Crazy. Of.
No, we have footage now.
We do? Since when?
We'll see, because we haven't been together. But I'll have to, you know what? When we're done the show, I'll set to, yes. It's a while ago, actually. It surfaced.
Oh, because we were looking for that forever, because I wanted to see your injury.
Yeah.
Which sounds mean, but you know
what it was. No, I know. But somebody posted it. And when I found it, I think it had only been like 2 weeks since they posted it.
Oh, excellent.
So the footage does exist. So maybe we'll have to do like a link or something when we post this, maybe some connection.
We'll figure something out. We'll tweet it or something. It's okay. There. So you broke your collarbone. You were hungry for hot dogs.
So I broke my collarbone. I was hungry for hot dogs. What we didn't know, though, that night, we didn't know that I broke it. And a few weeks after that match, I had gone to Cincinnati for a WWF camp. And it was in that WWF camp. I think it was like the second or third day we were doing something. And my shoulder was sore all along. But there was still mobility. Like usually when people break their collarbone, you kind of have to hold it in tight. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can't really move it. And I was still able to move it. And I kind of worked around as best I could, but it just got to the point, like I couldn't do anything. So they sent me to get x-rays. And when they came back with the x-rays, they did both collarbones, and they're like, okay, well, here's like your left collarbone and here's, you know, this and that, and that's how it's supposed to look. And then they put up the other one, the right side, and he goes, and this is your right side. And I had broken the bone completely in two. Oh. And it was like resting on top of each other.
Okay.
So that's why, because
which
it was still sort of
a little bit of mobility. Yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, and I still like, and so they didn't end up, they decided like surgery wouldn't be a good idea because it was already like the bone was already starting to fuse. So it could possibly be worse. So they just kind of like left it. So I stuck out the rest of the camp there. And then flew back to Puerto Rico. And then I think within like a week or two, I flew back home to Edmonton to recover. And so while back, WWF was coming through. D'Lo Brown, who I had met in Puerto Rico because he had spent some time there.
You speak very highly of D'Lo as well.
Yes. Awesome guy. He was always great to me, him and Chaz and Pete Gass, because kind of the three of them kind of got sent down together to Puerto Rico. And so they kind of took me under their wing. So I kind of hung with them. WWF was doing the Alberta run. They were doing Calgary, Red Deer, Edmonton. So I talked to D'Lo and it was like, okay, well, you know what? Like, I'll come meet up with you in Red Deer. And I'll, you know, we can drive back to Edmonton. I can drive you around and look after you. And he's like, yeah, come to the show, all that kind of the good stuff. So drove out to Red. They did their show in Calgary. I still remember he drove with Stevie Richards to Red Deer. And then he and I hooked up. We went to the show that night in Red Deer, just obviously a house show. The one kind of notable thing, little story that I love to tell here is I met a young up and comer there. it was funny because, you know, we're backstage and dressing room, whatever. And D'Lo's like, hey, you know, come on over here. You know, why don't you meet my buddy? This is Andy. You know, he's a great wrestler. He's been in the business for, you know, 5-6 years, whatever. And so this youngster came over, shook my hand. He's like, hey, man, like, nice to meet you. And, you know, just kind of exchanged pleasantries real quick. And then that was kind of it. And you may have heard of that young man. He went on to fame. His name was Brock Lesnar.
Bork Laser. That's a cool story.
Yeah, so that was
was he not at that camp that you were at?
No, Batista was at the camp.
Kurt Angle and Edge also, or am I?
No, there's the first. So I went to two camps. Okay. My first camp was in 2000, and at that one, Road Warrior Hawk was there, the Blue Meanie was there, Kevin Quinn, who was friends with CM Punk. He was there. Barry Houston, who did some independence, but also some enhancement stuff. Kurt Angle was one there, so I got to work with Kurt and have some fun with him. Those are kind of so did I say the Blue Meanie already?
Yes.
Blue Meanie was there. Yeah. Okay. And then Glamour Boy Shane, he was there as well. And there was a big guy, Leroy Sprecht or something like that. He ended up going on to be an actor.
Okay.
But so those were the guys, and then Batista was there, but he was hurt, so he was kind of hanging around but not really doing anything.
Okay.
So those were the guys. That was that one, and then this other camp, the one that where I finally ended up, you know, finding out I had the broken collarbone. Bobby Roode was there. Daphne from WCW fame. April Hunter was there. Where are the other guys? Rick Michaels from like NWA Georgia. I think Ron Waterman or something, he was there. Johnny Jeter was there because he was my roommate. Sylvain
Grenier.
He was one of the French. Yeah, he was there. Who else was it? Those ones. Those were like the main guys.
All right, get to the hot dogs.
That one. Okay, so anyways, yes. Okay, so good thing we don't get sidetracked.
Easily. I gotta keep you on track here.
Please do. Yeah, so we did. There was that show that night, and then we drove back to Edmonton. I think I dropped D'Lo off in his hotel, and it's like, okay, you know, like the next day, we can go to the gym, and then we can go to Raw. So we go to Raw. And Tommy Dreamer's there. And so Tommy Dreamer, I already know him from him coming to Puerto Rico.
Okay.
So he was there. We brought in several guys right before 9/11 happened. I think we had like a big show, like it was like the weekend before, something like that. So like they got out just in time. But he was always super cool. He appreciated my work. And he even told me, he said like if ECW was still around, you'd be working in ECW. So that was quite the stamp of approval. I was always kind of grateful to hear that. But anyways, like he saw me, he's like, hey, like, you know, like you're here. Let's try and get you involved. You know, you want to do something. I'm like, well, yeah. I said, like, I can't really work because you know, I'm recovering from the broken collarbone. And so he said, okay, give me some time. And then a little while later, I think D'Lo had gone somewhere and wherever I was. And then D'Lo comes, he's like, hey, like, you know, Tommy's looking for you. Okay, cool. So he's like, hey, you know, we're going to do this deal with the hot dogs and da, 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 da. And, you know, you want to do it? I'm like, well, absolutely, of course. So they gave me a WWE cap and a t-shirt. And it's like, okay, we're going to put you in the, you know, in the front row. Right before the segment comes, we'll get one of the guys from the magic department, whatever, they'll bring you like a box of hot dogs.
Are these shoot hot dogs or working hot dogs?
They were, because that way I could actually eat them. And it's like, you know, you got like ketchup, like whatever. I was like, well, I don't like ketchup, like mustard relish. So they put on lots of mustard because the mustard would be very visible and easy to see, right?
Makes sense.
So that's why the lots of mustard. So anyways, Tommy comes out and he's doing his spiel in the middle of the ring. And he's like, oh, you know, whatever, he's talking about like grossing out people. And he's kind of stops, like he's distracted. And he comes out. He's like, hey, like, you know, like what you eating there? He's like, well, you know, and I meanwhile, like, I'm like legit eating the hot dogs. And I think there was like, there must have been like, it's either four or six.
I remember it being like a big box. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there must have been like six just to make sure, like for effect. So when I was eating the one, and then, you know, he goes to grab it, and it's kind of like, you know, it's like, you're kind of fumbling around, and then all the hot dogs drop on the floor. It's like, oh man, you know, I'm so sorry. Let me help you pick those up. So it's like, he steps over the barrier. And of course, when he steps over the barrier, he steps on the hot dog. He's like, oh no, man. Like, you know, like perfectly good hot dog. So he picks it up and he starts eating the hot dog. And I think he offered to one of the fans beside, and the fan actually started eating it too. Like, but, that was kind of the extent of it there. And then afterwards, I think Undertaker came out, and then that's where Undertaker forced him to, drink the chewing tobacco.
That's pretty nasty. Yeah.
So I'll give you another story to that right. night though. So I was fortunate, and I can't remember if this is actually when D'Lo found me or not, but at this time, so I also, I mean, I you know, because you get to know several of the guys, because some of the guys come to Puerto Rico, would get brought in, or there's the odd time that we kind of did like a joint like IWA WWE show, because Savio, Miguel Perez and Victor were the owners of the IWA. So there was still some connection with WWE. It was sort of a bit of a quote unquote developmental territory ish. Mm-hmm. And that's how like D'Lo and Chaz and Pete Gass got sent there. Steve Bradley, there was another guy, he was under contract. He got sent there. Tiger Ali Singh or Tiger, yes, Junior, whatever. He got sent there. And Eddie Guerrero, I think that was after the first time when he got released from WWE, he came to work there. And one of the things that I ended up doing over time is, because I could, you know, again, good guy, responsible, I could speak some Spanish, and I was always driving. So when we were going to shows and stuff, it was like, I was always by one of the guys, Ricky Santana, Fidel Sierra, they kind of had me right from the get-go doing that. And that was so that I could learn the island and learn how to drive like a Puerto Rican, and you know where all the buildings were. So when new guys would come in, or you know, we'd get some guys in for the weekend, normally I'd pick them up from the airport, and then I could take them to the hotel. I could kind of give them the lay of the land, and you know, help out however I could. So I got to do this with a lot of guys, including Eddie Guerrero. So we kind of struck up a bit of a friendship. He was super cool with me. I took him to the gym a couple times and whatnot. So fast forward now back to the 2002, we're backstage. So this same night, there is also a match that actually kind of has some infamy. And
oh, is this the ladder match?
This is the ladder match. Okay. So what kills me, and I don't regret anything, but just the hindsight that I coulda, shoulda, woulda. So I was actually sitting in the dressing room. It was an empty dressing room. It was just Rob Van Dam and Eddie Guerrero and me. Hmm. And they were going over the match. And, you know, so I mean, I'm, you know, obviously I'm listening, I'm intent, and, you know, mouth shut, ears open.
Of course.
And so I know the gist of everything that's going on in this match. So when the time comes and the match happens, I'm sitting in my one corner, and then this goof eventually comes out. I think Eddie's starting to ascend the ladder, and this guy comes out. He's got an Oilers jersey.
What
and it's
else?
Like, I'm watching him. Yeah. And it's like, I'm watching it. And it's like one of those things, like, you know, it's a fan, like it's obviously a fan. And part of me was like, should I stop this guy?
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't. And he got in, and he kind of messed the ladder. And then I think Eddie, you know, started putting the boots to him and all that. But it's just one of those things that you, like, who knows? Like, I mean, you know, I could have jumped in there, stopped him. I'm sure we both would have got pulled back. And then eventually they'd have been like, hey, like, this guy's one of the boys. You know, would it have got me a contract? Probably not. Would it have, you know, maybe got me some extra favor or something? Yeah. Who knows? But it's just one of those things where it's like, man, like I should have.
Yeah, because I was there that night, but I was sitting up very high. And at first, we all thought it was Austin, because all we could see was a bald guy in an Oilers jersey, and we thought it might have been Austin, but yes, it was not.
Yeah, because he was like right across. It was like right across, you know, like almost like blue line to blue line, kind of like looking across the blue line, and I could see it, and it's like what's this guy doing? Like, he's not supposed to. And it's like, okay,
well,
and I just, but whatever. But thankfully, nobody got hurt. I mean, if the guy got hurt, he deserved it, because he shouldn't be doing that in the first place. But I mean, Rob Van Dam didn't get hurt. You know, the ref didn't get hurt. Eddie didn't get hurt.
Eddie was all pissed. Good.
Yes. Yes, he was.
Right. Okay. We're going to go to your second track. And after that, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about beer. But your second track is from one of your favorite artists, which is Kid Rock, as you mentioned earlier. Tell me about this one and why. Why? Tell me
why. All right. Why? It's, I was debating, you know, when we were talking prior to this the other day, it's like, okay, you're like, pick two songs. It's like, well, you know, I picked my favorite song of all time. So it's like, well, I should pick like an Elvis song because it's, you know, I'm an Elvis guy. And when people say, what's your favorite Elvis song? Well, I don't have just one because it depends on the mood. And that's how it is with Kid Rock. You know, like, do you have one? It's like, well, no, because sometimes I like this one. Sometimes I like this, you know, this one. This one, his latest album came out maybe 2 years ago. I think it's called Sweet Southern Sugar. I know Kid Rock can be very polarizing for people and whatever. I love his music. I love his voice. And this one, it's kind of like a... Did you listen to it already?
I took a quick gander when I pulled it.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a, I mean, it's a rock and roll song.
Yes,
but it's not like hyped up. And I don't know, it's just something. I get it because I love Tennessee. You know, from wrestling to barbecue to Elvis to music history. I just love Tennessee, and this is just a very, like, it's a feel good song for me. I can listen to it when I'm driving. I actually even have it on my, workout playlist.
And, have you been to Pigeon Forge?
No, I was actually booked. I'll say like, I'm like a work a match. You know, but maybe not everybody listening knows. I had a heart attack about almost six years ago.
Is it that long now? Holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And it happened at the end of August. At the time,
Sorokin's kid almost did you in.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. But you know, we had like a family trip planned, and it was going to Tennessee, and it was like to do like Memphis and Nashville, and Pigeon Forge, and there was going to be a Kid Rock concert going on at that time. The Oilers were playing Nashville at that time because the trip was booked for, I think, October.
Okay.
And part of it was to go to Pigeon Forge and like the Smoky Mountains and Dollywood and all that stuff. And I had the heart attack and then couldn't go on the trip. So it's I'd still like to hopefully go back one day and check it out.
All right. So back to Kid Rock.
Yeah.
Or is that's pretty much it?
Awesome song.
Okay.
That's pretty much it. It's just the love for Tennessee, the love for Kid Rock, and it's I don't know, it's just a feel-good song for me, so I hope people enjoy it.
All right, let's check out some Kid Rock on the Punk and Potters podcast on the Backbreaker Media Network.
From palm trees and beautiful hips, man, it doesn't get any better than this. The sun set like fire on the Viper Room. Oh, let me hold up at the bar. I'm Johnny Depp picking on an old guitar. Man, I wish old Keith would have taught him how to keep in tune. I came here looking for love, but all I found was sex and drugs. Strung out, broke down, homesick, and thinking of you. Still packing a gun.
You better ask somebody.
Singing karaoke in a double wide. We smoke so thick it'll burn your eyes. Oh, my sweet Lord, how warm are you? Fall in love with an angel. You'll end up in California. Was on the 405 in a jacked up rocky rig, straight rolling coal. But then I turned up the radio and heard a bunch of shit that's got no soul. All popping hip hop, but no damn rock and roll.
No rock and roll.
I came here looking for love, but ended up on a bathroom rug. God, please see me through.
Kid Rock on the Puck and Potterverse podcast on the Backbreaker Media Network. My name is Big Bad Boris, joined by Andy Anderson, who now, again, maybe I'm making this more romantic in my mind than it is because I think it's cool. But did you not go on a beer run for the Sandman once? Or am I reinventing history?
No. You are correct.
You were back WrestlePalooza 97?
Yeah, I think it was like in Cobb County, Georgia.
Did you ever get down to Cobb County, Georgia?
I did. Thankfully, I didn't get arrested.
I drove through it once. I was worried I was going to do some hard time, but I made it through.
Nope. Yeah. The Cobb County, Georgia. So do you want the backstory to how I ended up there, or do you just want the beer story?
If you can do it quickly.
Okay.
I try to keep the show to like a tight hour-ish. And you're a very verbose gentleman who and I'm not,
yeah,
like,
absolutely.
It's not a criticism. It's just an observation.
No. Yeah, no. And I like to, okay. So long story short, earlier in the show, I talked about doing Georgetown, Kentucky shows, Mountain Wrestling Association with Tracy Smothers. We did an angle there. We were heels and Tracy was working with ECW at the time. The big thing we set up was that if, we had talked with Paulie Dangerously, and if Andy Anderson could remain undefeated between that time and the time that this pay-per-view came up, he was going to get a spot on the pay-per-view. Ooh. So of course it was, you know, being a heel, and that was the whole thing, was to beat me. The week prior to the pay-per-view, I lost a cage match to Wildcat Chris Harris. That's who I was involved in the feud with.
Oh.
And so I wasn't going to be able to be on the pay-per-view. Fans were crazy. But anyways, I was obviously still going. So I went with Tracy to the pay-per-view. We were hanging out. That was my first time meeting Tommy Dreamer. And he told me I could not appear in the pay-per-view when people were handing out heads for Al Snow. But at one point, so Cobb County, Georgia, I guess, was a dry county, meaning they didn't serve alcohol on Sundays. And
well, this just won't do, will it?
Well, no, not if you're the Sandman. So somehow it came around to me through, through Tracy. And I think I was wearing jeans that it was August, one of the rare days I was wearing jeans, probably because I wanted to look presentable for ECW being backstage. But I went, it must have been Sandman's car, into the trunk, and I was grabbing as much beer as I could. I was sliding them in my socks. I was sliding them in around my belt. And however I could kind of walk in without kind of look too inconspicuous, I did a, is that like a moonshine beer run across state lines or Cobb County, Georgia, Civic Center lines to make sure the Sandman had some beer.
That's a good story. Now I'm going to tell you one of my favorite Andy Anderson stories. This is a number of years old now. Is back. You stopped working Calgary shows because you just don't like Calgary, I guess, for some reason, taste or what have you. But you used to work Calgary shows, and I remember one particular Calgary show many years ago. You were all about, after the show, we're going to Peter's, and you were just excited as shit to go to Peter's. And after the show, you're on everyone's ass like stink on shit to get that ring crew done, because you're like, we want to go to Peter's.
Yeah, they close at midnight.
Peter's closes at midnight. And you were all excited. And we piled into Kurt's van. I think we rode with Kurt for some reason. I can't remember.
Yeah, we were with Kurt. Yeah.
And we got to Peter's at 11:57. And there were still people in there. And they wouldn't serve you. And you were mad.
I very rarely get upset, and that was one of the few times.
You literally sat, like, if you know Peter's in Calgary, they have like the walk-up little like window thing. You sat. I had a picture of it. I don't know if I still do. I wish I did.
I was gonna say, I think either you or Kurt had a picture of me sitting
I did.
There.
You're literally sitting on the ground in front of the window. And to this day, one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And it's a story that always makes me smile almost as much as the time that I soundly defeated you and put you to sleep and sent you packing on your way.
I'm impressed. It's only the second time now on the show that we've gone this far that you brought
between
it up.
All the podcasts I've done and you've done, we've kind of beaten it to death, haven't we?
No, not really.
No. All right. Is there anything else that you want to mention? Are you planning on coming back to the ring once, whenever the
we get things going again.
I hope so, because it's one of the things. I mean, I can't go like I used to, and I can't do the things that I used to. But
yeah, you put a picture on Facebook the other day. You're doing a 450 splash, you little spot monkey bastard.
Right? All that flippy stuff. Yeah, no, I still hopefully want to be involved. I would say I'm not the most creative guy, but this is kind of where I kind of let my creative juices flow. And I enjoy what I do. I love working with the PWA. I'm always grateful for Kurt for bringing me in. And I'm always grateful for everybody that I get to work with and puts up with me and listens to me. And, you know, as much as I rag on the fans of PWA, this will be the rare opportunity that I'll take and say, like, PWA, especially in Edmonton, the fans are awesome. And they love to hate me, which is good because I hate them. So,
and let's be honest, the bottom rope doesn't kick itself, right?
No, it doesn't. And nobody kicks the bottom rope like I do.
So one of the things I like to ask people who are wrestlers, because I've often found them in two categories, either they're wrestlers who don't watch wrestling or wrestlers who watch a lot of wrestling. What are you watching these days? I know you do another podcast, if you guys want to give them a plug or whatever. Even though I talk about indie wrestlers that no one's ever heard of, but that's just me, you know, whatever.
So I do a couple of podcasts every week there with the wrestling POV crew, Rick Serrano III, Tony Diaz, T. James Logan, Elio Canella, Clay Cummings. There's a, on the network, we've got several different shows, but the ones that I work with are WPOV Quarantine, which is me, Tom, and Elio. That one, I always, and you've been on that show a couple times. Mm-hmm. I call that one, it's for the love of wrestling, for the love of the business. And we have,
as long as you don't like indie wrestlers. I'm just being a dick.
Anyways, I know you do it well. It's not as good as me in the ring, but you know, it's okay. We talk about everything. We have all kinds of guests on. I believe we have the Pope coming up.
Reverend Al Sharpton.
Reverend Al Sharpton's on the cover. all kinds of guests. You know, we've had from Bushwhacker Luke, you know, to Ron Fuller, to Bill Dundee, Evan Ginsberg, Greg Oliver, we've all kinds of people. So
Griffin McCoy.
Cool. Griffin, you know what? I was actually going to bring up Griffin McCoy because he was just on another episode recently. So
yeah. you know what he is, right?
Is he a spot monkey?
No, he's an indie wrestler.
Oh, is he? He very cool dude though.
I really enjoyed it. I was on one of the shows with him. Super good guy.
Yeah. So, and we have all kinds of topics. You know, we talk history, we talk angles, we talk favorites, you know, you name it. And we do that. And then the other show that I do, that one drops Wednesdays, I believe. And then the other one we do is WPOV Global, which there's a light sprinkle of like maybe like Impact and New Japan, but it predominantly focuses on AEW Dynamite. And so that's what I guess watch because I mean I have to watch it for the show, like for the podcast. These days Raw, SmackDown, I usually kind of skim through the pay-per-views. I'll watch through, you know, I'll watch it if I'm able to. I'll watch it as it happens, because sometimes we do, well, there's usually the WPOV crew, we do aftermath after like major pay-per-views. So if I can watch the whole show, then I do that. Then I usually do the pay-per-view or the aftermath. Otherwise, again, like I might skim through, like if I read the results, be like, oh, like this happened, and I'll check out for kind of like highlights. But that's
starting on Friday, I guess they're back in front of live crowds again, hey?
Yeah. Yeah, so hopefully that'll be good for everybody. It'll be good for the boys and the girls, and good for business, good for the fans. It'll be interesting to see now from what's happened over the past, you know, year and a bit, how things may change, or maybe this is one of those things where the more things change, the more they stay the same. We'll find out.
All right. In closing, we would be remiss.
Wait a minute. I'm not going anywhere. I just got here.
In closing, I think it'd be remiss if we didn't mention the passing of Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. And I thought about it, and I remember something a long, long, long time ago in whatever year it was that he turned on Hogan. And I remember thinking to myself when I was a kid who was like 10 years old, how come Hulk Hogan's friends never stay as friends? Every friend Hulk Hogan has ends up beating him up. If I knew then what I knew now, I wouldn't be so surprised.
As we often talk about on our WPOV podcast, and there's a veteran of the States, Chief Atakula Kula, he's, you know, Hulk Hogan is not a good friend. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the thing. It's like, you could talk about anybody. It's like, you know, you and I could talk trash about somebody and be like, hey, you know, is that guy a worse friend than Hulk Hogan?
No. But, he did well in the South starting off, if I remember correctly. Obviously, great run in the WWF, and he kind of closed out his career in WCW. Always looked in great shape, always had good matches. And sad to see Mr. Wonderful go.
Yeah, he was a legit tough guy, too. That's one of the other things we hear about. And it's more and more are passing, and it goes to show, you know, time moves on. It doesn't stop for everybody, and we're getting older.
Well, it's funny, a friend of mine that's a wrestling fan that I don't talk to as much as I should, good guy, sent me a picture. He texted me a picture of the Heenan family, like a nice graphic of the Heenan family, and they're all gone.
Yeah,
like the picture I'm looking at right now, from left to right, it's Andre,
yeah,
and then Bundy,
yeah,
and then Orndorff, and then Bobby the Brains in the middle,
yeah,
and then Kurt Hennig, Rick Rude, and Big John Studd.
Yeah. And to go one more.
If you think about Hercules and Harley Race as well. So, yeah. You know.
I think Haku is kind of like one of the only ones that's left.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about old Haku. He'll never die. Death is afraid of Haku.
No, exactly. The other one that I, because I saw that graphic, so I know which one you're talking about. The other one that popped up that I saw was that all of Hulk Hogan's opponents from WrestleMania's 1-6 have all passed on.
I guess so, yeah. And yeah, Yokozuna crazy. As well. That was what, 9?
Yeah.
Well, we say rest in peace to Mr. Wonderful.
Yes, sir.
Anything else that you want to add? Anything you want to say? Any points of view?
I'm just getting started. I'm single. I'm ready to mingle. Where's Ted at? Where you at, Ted? Let's
talk about some music. How's the kids? How's the girls?
The girls are awesome. You know what? Maybe, you know what? Because, and I know we're almost done here, and there's so much more we could talk about. Maybe we should just touch on what what that was that I just did and kind of sprinkle some out there so people don't think that we're
okay
any more crazy than we already are.
You introduced me to the wonderful world of James Brown.
Yes.
And you also introduced me to the single greatest 4 minutes of television that CNN has ever broadcast. CNN used to have a show back when I was a kid called Sonya Live. And I think it was kind of like Larry King Live, but with a woman named Sonya. And she did an interview with the Godfather of Soul, James Brown, where he may or may not have been enjoying a substance or a beverage or
two or both. Possibly under the influence
Influence. And it was just after he got arrested for abusing his wife. And it's quite an interview. He's all over the map.
It's probably one of those things where, like, in the realm of, you know, oh, okay, well, he's, you know, using stuff. Like, it's not funny, but it's an incredible. Oh, And the fact that Sonya keeps it together so well, it's actually a credit to her of how professional she was through the whole thing. So for Boris and I, there has been nights in the past where we'd watch it repeatedly, probably sprinkled with like some Iron Sheik promos.
Oh, we must have watched that like 1,000 times, and it's still fun.
Oh, and we quote it, and there's like the gifs or the gifs and all that. I mean, you had it. I mean, I had it down pretty good, but like you had it down pat.
Yeah. So and, go to when we're done here, which is a few moments from now. Go to.
Not if I have anything to do with it.
Go. I got to work tomorrow. Go to your YouTube machine and just punch in James Brown CNN, and it'll show up.
It is just amazing.
You mentioned Iron Sheik, and it's interesting that you mentioned that because that kind of ties into. The song that we're going to go out to, because there's a band that I discovered just by this is a couple of years ago, maybe. And I saw the name and I thought, that's hilarious. It's a band called Iron Sheik, Sheik spelled C-H-I-C. And I thought it was going to be like a comedy band or whatever. And I checked out the album, yeah. And it's just a really, really, really good punk rock band that write really, really, really good songs. And they're called Iron Sheik. And
really, it's fantastic. Really, really,
really, really, really. So they have a brand new single they just released a couple of weeks ago. It's called Catgut. The band is called Iron Sheik, and it's super, super good. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you like it, check those guys out. Anything else that you want to, when you want to throw out your social medias or your third grade teacher or your, any algebra lessons?
No, still haven't used the algebra. I'm on Twitter at Andy Anderson, PWA, on Instagram. It's I'm that guy. So the letters I M T H A T G U Y T C B 247. It's mostly me doing stuff in the gym, sprinkled with my wrestling POV podcasts and reliving my glory years of wrestling. But check it out if you're interested.
There are many more still to come. So Ryan Nugent Hopkins pretty much guaranteed himself never winning Stanley Cup. Hey.
just like the rest of the Calgary Flames, I guess.
Hey, so I think we're gonna lose Giordano to the Kraken, but you know what, to make an omelet you got to break some eggs, am I right?
There you go.
All right, for real though, thank you so much for doing this is super fun, and I know you have a zillion million stories, so we'll definitely have to do a part two. Everybody that's come on wants to come on again, like Pat wants to come on again, and MRB wants to come on again. You should listen to Pat's got some good stories, and he talks extensively about his Elvis impersonating career, so there's some interesting stuff there.
Oh, nice.
So if you get a chance, check that one out. But yeah, thank you very much.
Oh no, the pleasure, well, as I said to start the show, the pleasure was all yours. It's still all yours, but you know, me. I love you, and I pleasure for me, most famous podcast, Backbreaker Media, Pile Driver Punk, whatever, pleasure for me. Thank you to all my intelligent wrestling fans around the world. The big bad Boris, number one Backbreaker Media. Have a good day. Peace.
The Heli Belly Jim.
Heli Belly. Maybe I take him out back. I break him like the camel.
All right. We're going to go out to Catgut. This is Iron Sheik. Thank you for listening. If everything goes according to plan, Colton Kelly's up next week. So you guarantee some interesting stories from Colton Kelly, as well as I'm sure he's going to drop a couple of hip hop tracks. So that'll be kind of fun. This has been Talking Pile Drivers. My name is Big God Boris. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Iron Sheik. And we will talk to you guys next week.